All right, everyone. Our next speaker is John Gale, and I promise I will get that name correct this time. All right, Mr. Gale is CEO of Community Housing and Therapy, a charity specializing in psychotherapy with many programs, including one for homeless veterans. He's formerly a Benedictine monk. He was a director of studies and lectured in philosophy and early church history. After leaving the priesthood, he trained as a psychotherapist and has worked in therapeutic communities for over 20 years. He's the clinical director of Community Housing and Therapy before being appointed to his present post in 1999. So would you kindly welcome John Gale.
Like ascending the gallows, kind of here in this hall of shrine of psychoanalysis. How do I put this thing on? Something like that. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks so much. I'm going to say a few descriptive things about the charity I run and the program that the charity runs for traumatized and homeless veterans, and then I'll sort of try to say something a little more reflective about two aspects of the program. One is about homelessness, and the other is about community. Community Housing and Therapy is a registered charity that runs therapeutic communities which help people who are experiencing severe mental ill health gain a foothold in the world by positioning themselves in relation to the other and to language, and by finding stabilization in relation to the community rather than to their symptoms. We treat around 150 patients a year. Most people admitted to our programs have a psychosis, or what is known in psychiatry as a personality disorder, or complex trauma. Many have served in the armed forces and been homeless. Our staff team comprises of around 45 psychotherapists or trainee psychotherapists. We run a comprehensive postgraduate training program in psychoanalytic psychotherapy, which is accredited by Middlesex University. And we also run conferences and workshops, including a series of therapeutic community masterclasses that are held at the Freud Museum. We also run an international network and have over 1,200 members, professionals in 65 different countries. Since its foundation, CHT, as it's known, has developed a particular therapeutic community style through an engagement in Lacanian psychoanalytic theory, psychoanalysis being the founding idea of therapeutic communities, according to Hinshelwood, and by reflecting on the philosophical foundations of community through a consideration of Heidegger's philosophy. Homebase, the project we run for the homeless veterans, was set up, was named Homebase by an old soldier who I think hadn't actually heard of Sainsbury's Homebase. It's rather embarrassing. set up on the recommendation of the Homeless Fund, to address the lack of psychological services available at that time for the ex-service community. That's changed an awful lot. Now there are quite a lot of programs for the ex-service community. We run it in partnership with the trauma service of the Tavistock and Portman NHS Foundation Trust, and it treats approximately 50 people a year by delivering a comprehensive program which includes accommodation, psychotherapy and rehabilitation, including retraining for work. Each placement lasts approximately a year, with the majority of individuals gaining work within the first 6 months and being discharged to permanent accommodation at the end of treatment, though some may continue in psychotherapy at the Tavistock Trauma Service. Homebase receives only a very small amount of statutory funding in the form of a Supporting People grant, but from the beginning has been generously supported by the ex-service benevolent funds, particularly the Army Benevolent Fund, and other charitable trusts. Many of those referred to Homebase suffer from complex trauma, most of the things that I'm going to refer to will have heard before. That's one of the disadvantages of speaking late in the conference. The advantage is you've all had lunch, you'll probably doze off and won't notice. The majority suffer from complex trauma, which may trigger post-traumatic stress disorder, depression or anxiety. And they often come from very deprived backgrounds, mostly very deprived backgrounds, and have experienced trauma during childhood. This may have included physical abuse, sometimes torture, bereavement, family separation, and other reasons for grief and loss. Indeed, research from Southampton University has shown that a large proportion of homeless people in general, not just ex-military people, experience complex trauma. Often they feel a strong sense of failure and guilt. A number will have been diagnosed with a personality disorder. And these problems that they have are frequently exacerbated by alcohol and drug abuse, unemployment, inadequate life skills. Nearly all have a very limited support network, suffer from lack of self-esteem, and feel worthless, and find it hard to form and maintain relationships. More than 70% of our recent clients have served in at least one conflict zone, including Northern Ireland, the Falklands, the Gulf, former Yugoslavia. Recently, we've had an increase of individuals who've served in Afghanistan. Most serve in the army, and mostly come from the infantry regiments. Many will have found the army as an escape from traumatic situations or traumatic home life. And their time in the services will often have been extremely positive and a meaningful one, which through identification with their unit, group cohesion, clear boundaries and structures in which there are fundamental agreements about that demarcate the law, they will have developed a sense of identity, strengthened ego, a far greater sense of self-worth than at any other time in their lives. And this sense of identity is set to remain with them for the rest of their lives. Generally, for the rest of their lives, they will describe themselves as an ex-soldier. However, on discharge from the armed forces, they will have struggled to adapt to civilian life, found it hard to feel any sense of belonging in the world, hard to hold down a job, have started drinking excessively, maybe using drugs. Relationships will have deteriorated and they will have ended up homeless. That sort of describes the service we run and the charity and who comes to the service. I'd now like to change gears slightly and just try to reflect a little bit on the meaning of homelessness and on the meaning of community, value of community. I picked up these two things specifically because I think those are things which nobody else would have spoken about. So, and hopefully, you know, most of you won't know anything about it, so you won't know how inadequate it is. First of all, I'd like you to imagine those great, vast cemeteries, war cemeteries in northern France. Or picture the cenotaph, or mausoleum, or perhaps even those war memorials that we have on village greens throughout the countryside. In these physical objects, we encounter the topology of absence. It's an absence whittled out in stone and wood. As its Latin roots indicate, the architectural monument honoring the dead is there to remind us of absence. It is quite literally a memorial, a monumentum to what has been erased. Architecture articulates this within a distinctive discourse of spatiality that characterizes the lost object. Walls, roofs, towers wrap around an interior emptiness, paradoxically creating containment for what has been wiped out. Before all else, homelessness shares a discourse with these monuments. That is to say, homelessness speaks to us of an absence. Not primarily because in the past the homeless person had a home, although he and she may well have done, but because it is absence that homelessness and the past both articulate. And the reason why this might be important is because it suggests that the past could just give us a clue about the meaning of homelessness. So I'm going to say something about the past now. Of course, our ability to record and transcribe the past is limited by the availability of materials and the conditions under which we preserve texts and artifacts. This alone immediately calls into question the objective historical status of the past, and that these objects record. But this objectivity is also called into question by the operation of repression. That is to say, the past, as we enshrine it in memorials or in collections in archives, libraries, dare I say it, museums, is never uncontaminated. Rather, it is pre-constituted. As such, these relics of the past are redacted and inscribed within a mythology that is dependent on, to use Lacan's term, a discordance, a splitting between the past and the present, that in its turn rests on a chronological model of temporality. This fragmentation or estrangement accelerates the process of petrification in which artifacts, rather than remaining meaningful in the present, become marginalized into the folkloric and seen deceptively as somehow belonging to the past. Now, psychoanalysis, as you know, turns this view of history on its head by recognizing the relationship between the past and the present is not one of succession, but one of imbrication and of repetition. It's an overlapping, like roof tiles. The past and the present are on top of each other, repeatedly. Homelessness, seen as a symptom of absence, is then a most appropriate and fertile start for psychotherapy. Indeed, one of the things that homeless charities, as opposed to psychotherapy charities, you could say, homeless charities struggle with is the curious way in which their beneficiaries repeatedly return to being homeless after being housed, despite their conscious wish to settle down and their conscious demands to be housed and rehoused. Memory, which of course is so deeply connected with history, the past, memory is not only constituted by this absence, it also veils it. It veils the absence. This veiling, or sheltering, to use Derrida's idiom, is characteristic of repression. For what is excluded infiltrates the place from which it originated. Michel de Certeau describes this localized resurfacing as turning the present feeling of being at home into an illusion. What is repressed, that is to say, dwells within an index locorum, which is, before all else, founded on a displacement. Providing a home to the homeless does not, in other words, banish homelessness for long. Like the past, which returns to haunt the present, the obscene horrors that are manifest in the symptom of homelessness are soon found lurking within the walls of the residence itself, and the anguish returns. Now, the homeless often feel this sense of dislocation, not as just as something outside themselves, like not having a location, but an internal dislocation, a sense of a lack of belonging to the world. Roger Kennedy describes this eloquently as a kind of psychic homelessness. According to Heidegger, self and world, this is a quotation, are not two entities like subject and object, or like you and I. Rather, self and world are basic determinants of Dasein, being there, of existence itself, in the structure of being in the world. When he said that strange sort of thing, Heidegger was challenging a tradition in modern philosophy, which Husserl represents, which thinks of being in the world as a relationship that a subject has to objects. According to Keller, Heidegger seeks to undercut this picture by arguing that we have no freestanding conception of a human being as a subject that could exist independently of the distinctive spatiality that characterizes what it is to be a human being. To put it very simply, human existence is only found within a particular place. That is to say, even when somebody describes themselves as homeless, even someone we describe as homeless only exists in relation to a location, even if it is a place where there is no sense of home. And the possibility that place might have a therapeutic function is precisely because it has a relationship to being, to existence. It's an ontological issue. The expression, of course, going to the heart of being, is Freud's way to describe the psychoanalytic process. This relationship to place is fundamental to being, and because it is necessarily hermeneutic. It's not the same, for example, as the relationship which animals have to their location. Although as a cat owner I find that hard to believe. But let's stick with it. Because it is always mediated. It's a symbolic relationship. Our experiences of a place are meaningful experiences and are in consequence interpreted in some way. The hermeneutic factor, the interpretive factor, before all else, to use Wittgenstein's expression, means that language is man's primary dwelling place, our first home. Lacan says we're born into language. Because one cannot have a private language, Wittgenstein again, language implies a community of language users. If it's just a private language, it's a psychosis. As a former priest, you know, I like to give the example of the difference between religious belief, which often sounds completely nuts to an outsider, and psychosis. And the difference, of course, is that religious belief, however nutty it sounds, doesn't sound nutty to other people who believe it. Whereas in psychosis, the mad person does seem mad to his mad friend. The relationship which each of us has to place is therefore connected, deeply connected, ontologically connected, to the relationship we have to language. Therefore, language implies a community of language users, other people that accept and agree more or less on the meaning of the words we use, and therefore implies what Heidegger calls dwelling with, living with, being with others. The homeless person lives, that is to say, not simply in relation to a place which is not a home, not simply in relation to the absence of a home, but in relationship to the meaning he or she gives to the word homeless and to the others who use and understand the meaning of that word. Indeed, as speech and, in fact, language as a whole is something which not only belongs to a community, which only belongs to a community, to reside or to dwell is only a possibility within a world where meaning resides. For this reason, we can say that in one sense, no one lives entirely alone, because solitude is only meaningful in relation to presence. The experience of home or being homeless places a person within a particular history. This touches on the very interesting question about why the experience of war trauma in the First World War is different and the Second World War is different to now. Of course, the answer is the context, the culture. the experience is all based on our situation. It is inscribed. So the homelessness of the homeless person is inscribed within what Derrida calls a particular mentality. It's inscribed within the lexicon of a specific culture or paideia. Our history is both our own and yet at the same time, in some curious way, not our own. It's the product of a specific place. This is one of the reasons why some historical events occupy the forefront of a particular cultural awareness and other equally profound events are forgotten. This history is a tradition in thinking and the place where meaning unfolds. It's within this history that individuals make sense of their experiences of dwelling. And indeed, Lacan describes the unconscious for this reason as a register of memory. But it's also a tradition in the sheltering of absence. Indeed, the structure of the speech itself can be said to reflect this, because there is inevitably something which always remains still to be said, according to Gadamer. Something absent, something that escapes symbolization. Language, of course, being the most fundamental symbol. I don't know if you, it reminds me saying this, I don't know if you had similar experience, but I've sometimes had people who come to psychotherapy and they say, you know, they tell you very eloquently, tell you their story, the problem, what the problem is and all that. And then next week they come and they don't know what to say. And then you ask them to say something and they prompt them in some way and they say, well, you know, I've told you, I've done it, I've said it. And you end up sort of thinking, well, actually, you're going to be saying the same thing, you know, repetitively in different ways for the next couple of years. You know. Comes as something, as a shock. Thus, there's a linguistic character to our relationship with place, with home, with homelessness. And our understanding of our place in the world includes, most importantly, the experience of our first home and family, our first community. In the case of a large proportion of the homeless, their associations with place will be traumatic. And because of the distressing nature of their relationship with the place, it is usual that feelings of dislocation, will characterize the early stages of treatment. We shouldn't be surprised, therefore, when they seem to have no regard for the pleasant, homely environment we've carefully set out for them, or when they trash the residents. Indeed, often feelings of intense rage in relation to the physical environment will be expressed in destructive acts towards the residents, not just in the therapeutic community, towards the physical home, that may well be the case, but particularly in relation to the ethos, to the thinking, to the community. The notion of community, this brings me to the notion of community. Community has been used, an idea, what is community, you know? It's been used in a variety of different periods. Indeed, in its lexicographical archaeology, community is found in a series of disparate, mutating, and at times incongruent literary traces. Cohabitation, literally living in communion with a companion or a partner, becomes in Latin the monastic cenobium. The etymology of our English word companion, I thought was rather interesting, like the Italian compagno, the Spanish compañero, the French copain, comes from com and panis, with and bread, suggesting a shared meal sustains not just the body, but relationships. And in the therapeutic community, the shared meal often is a very important aspect of the coming together of the members. In some of its earliest Greek forms, the connotations of community are with taking part, specifically through inscription into a common language. In fact, it's from inscription into the symbolic that the notion of communication first emerges. Later still, by the beginning of our era, community has become a sharing in common, a conversation. Here, Paradigma Gadamer stammering to take part, becomes take part in the discourse and disclose and articulate meaning by participating is what counts. In a therapeutic community, this means more than words and the expressions which are common to the group, more than just learning the jargon. It's a commitment to thinking rather than settling for quick solutions, clichés or half-truths. It's an engagement in a process of reflection. And in fact, it's reflective thinking that characterizes the treatment in a therapeutic community. A commitment to the view that everything that happens, including those attacks on the residents and the attacks on the group, even when the placement breaks down, the return to homelessness itself has meaning. Rupert Hoare has discussed more recently five different conceptions of community, which he says vary in their degree of thinness in the sense of community. The thinnest use, but one which is common, he says, is to define community in terms of any form of living other than that inside a psychiatric hospital. According to this view, anything other than the hospital is thought to be intrinsically superior to the hospital. Yet the fact is that however poor the old asylums were, they often did indeed create a form of community. And for some people, the most difficult aspect of the transition from years of hospitalization into community care with the advent of care in the community was the veritable loss of a profound and real sense of belonging to a community. Taking absence seriously and taking language seriously, I'm suggesting, in our understanding of homelessness, calls into question the imaginary tropes of potency, the phallus, completion, wholeness, and self-fulfillment, the place of which always gives an a priori superiority to the future over the past, and in so doing implies a depreciation of what is present. According to De Certo, such an expectation, the word is the one Ricoeur uses to characterize modernity, depends on a postulate of individualism that was dismantled by Freudian discourse, for which the individual is merely a disguise. Now, this brings me back to community, something other than the individual, and to the overlapping roof tiles of the past and the present. Here, for the homeless veteran, the absence, which has many layers and many tissues, surely resonates with the loss of their unit, their military unit, in which past traumas were often held and contained, and in which they felt a deep sense of belonging. Thank you.
Thank you. What do you apply from your previous monastic existence to helping the homeless? And when governments question you, how do you describe the success of your unit or charity?
I should sort of prefix my talk by saying I'm hopeless at answering questions. I think terribly slowly. I don't know if it's particularly to do with our program for the homeless, but for the veterans, but in general, one of the things from my monastic background that I think of and try to, that seems useful, is the idea that in St. Benedict's rule, he says that the abbot should treat each person individually, so the ones who are weak shouldn't be overburdened, and the ones who are strong should be given enough of a challenge to keep them interested, and I often feel that's a useful little thought when dealing with staff. I shouldn't say too much about that because some of them are here. Governments, what is that? Governments,
when they judge your success.
We have quite a lot of research questionnaires that we give to our clients when they come in and when they go out, and probably at some points during the middle of treatment. I don't know how many, but we have very few, if any, returning to homelessness. Actually, in that sense, our client group, we're a bit lucky with our client group. Remember, they've been in the military. They have been functioning well. There might be the very odd one who sort of went in for 2 weeks and got thrown out because he had psychosis or something. But most of them will have been able to function well and to hold down a job in that structured context. The point is, that's a very structured environment. Rules and regulations, the law, castration, if you like. In that environment where there's a strong paternal regulator, this is often an environment, the structure that makes functioning much easier. And we sort of replicate that in a way in the therapeutic community with rules and regulations and protocols and so on.
Other questions? Well done.
Well, I think you basically touched on this, but I think just trying to catch up with what you said, to what degree do you consider a person returning to homelessness to be a reenactment of their primary experience of abandonment, if they had one? Is that basically what you were saying?
I was saying that... it is a regular feature of homeless people that they get housed by homeless agencies, and then 3 months later they're homeless again. And I was trying to connect that to the idea of the compulsion, repetition compulsion. And I'm sure there is a connection there, but I'm probably incapable of saying much more about it. It's my hunch of thinking about it.
Well, the term homelessness makes me think about a term that could possibly exist, urbanlessness. When we see people living far with the sprawl of cities, people living far from the city centers or what we could call communities. Could you enlighten it a little bit more or have ever thought about?
Yes.
The experience of isolation being something that someone who goes to live far from the city center starts to repeat in their lives and start not being able to go back.
Well, it's actually what the thought that you trigger in me is remembering some research that was done about people moving from rural communities in Africa to cities. And that's when they become isolated and lonely. Whereas in their rural communities, they were, it was much more a sense of community. It's the big city that's the one place hasn't got the sense of community. So some of these problems are probably problems of isolation and so on, loneliness, are probably the result of the anonymity of big cities, I suppose. I don't know if that's kind of right. Yes. Yes, yes. And the community thing is about, I think, about having a shared perspective, a shared experience, a shared perspective, the companionship. And that's what one of the features of being in the military unit, I'm sure Emil would be able to talk about that more, but, that's like-minded people having similar experiences and so on. That group cohesion, which is, group cohesion is one of the therapeutic community things to do.
I was wondering.
Oh God, I hoped you weren't going to ask me a question.
it's
going to be, take it away from her, it's going to be a difficult one.
No, it's very innocent. It's quite simple. It's just factual. Don't worry. I think that your presentation actually was so inspiring that I definitely need a copy, because I identified so much with a copy.
Me too.
A coffee and a copy. Anyway, just to ask you, when they leave, do you have contact remaining? They don't lose you completely. Have they got links with the with your community once they have moved out?
In general, I can't tell you precisely. My colleagues here probably could tell you better. But in general, most of the clients, whether they are veterans or not, that come to our services don't keep up contact with us. And they might do for a short time, and there might be odd ones that do. But in fact, one of the things that our partnership with the trauma service allows is that the person can continue in therapy after they've left us and be coming to the Tavistock. So there's a kind of continuity there that might be helpful. Yes.
We've got a few more minutes for other questions.
It's a very simple one. How do people actually come to you?
We have a huge network of referrers. It might be from a homeless hostel like The Passage or St. Martin in the Fields. It might be from another military charity like Veterans Aid or the British Legion. Could be from a number of... There are lots of these organizations that know we're on the map and, you know, combat stress or whatever people know they feel... Our place would be suitable for them, and our staff are in touch with these other agencies all the time. Yeah.
This may sound like a slightly facetious question, but you were talking about psychosis and religious belief, but it's possible for there to be a group psychosis, and we might even think about the military as being a kind of functioning quite crazily in a way. I mean, I don't mean any disrespect, but I mean, actually, you know, cohering people.
Yes,
to
I
go
just,
and just
I,
you know,
I,
it's I, purposeful, but actually entirely annihilation.
I couldn't agree more. And the thought came to my mind watching on the news recently, the Labour Party conference and the Lib Dems conference. I'm joking. Am I let off the hook now?
It sounds like the group is saying yes. Thank you again.
Begging
John, thank you.
Me to go.